We are joined on the telephone by the host of MSNBC Live, also co-host Velshi and Rule on MSNBC, and host the Modern Rules podcast. We're joined by Stephanie Rule this afternoon. I want to talk a lot about what's going on your podcast, but first we have to get to the news and ask you just to clarify for anybody who's not a constitutional scholar, what does this next step in the impeachment process mean?
Thus far, the testimonies that we've seen have been in private, and let's make something clear, it's what has always been the case. So right now, obviously, things are hyper-partisan, and people on one side will say, they're doing these hearings in private, they're only the Democrats are listening. Quickly, they're not only the Democrats listening. It's three investigative parties, three separate committees, where there are both Republicans and Democrats. Because it's Congress, and Congress has control, it's obviously more Democrats. But historically, these type of hearings are always done in private to begin with. In many ways, because you want to protect the people testifying so they don't coordinate their stories. The next step is for Congress to let all of those people who testified, thus far there's been 11, there'll be 14 by Friday, go through their testimonies that have been written and make sure they're accurate. And the next step, and Nancy Pelosi will lay it out, will be two-pronged. There will be a House vote, which the White House has been asking for. The White House has said they're not going to participate, they're not going to put forth witnesses, they're not going to give documents that have been requested until there's an official vote. And the reason the White House wants that is because it certainly forces Democrats that are in vulnerable districts to have to vote, and they don't want to do that. But Nancy Pelosi is going to hold a vote tomorrow. She may have waited until now because, as you know, it's part of her job to vote count and whip them up. So tomorrow there will be an official vote. And then after that, we're going to understand the roadmap. So assuming the vote clears, we're then going to get sort of a timeline, because the White House will now have to say if they're going to cooperate and give the documents that they've been asking for. And potentially, the 14 people who have testified will now, at least some of them, testify publicly. And the president will then have an opportunity to put forth witnesses that he wants to. He'll be able to speak his mind. He'll be able to bring in lawyers for himself. So it's sort of the next phase of the process. And it's interesting because until now, Republicans have been criticizing the process. Now they're going to be getting the process that they requested, and we'll see what happens next.
Even in Watergate, it took a while for it to become a bipartisan process, but can we ever get there the way things are today?
I wish I knew the answer. I know this. I know that I believe that people initially go into government not because they're so tied to a political party. I think they go into government because they care about our country and they're patriots and they care about leadership, and they'll put their country over their party. And it remains to be seen what people are going to do. But what's also very important is to think about voters. So on one hand, Republicans will say Democrats are doing nothing and voters care about kitchen table issues. They absolutely do. Voters are not thinking about a call with the president of Ukraine. But at the same time, the House has 300 bills sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk that he hasn't done anything with. And I think we misdiagnose things and say the president and his conduct and his behavior are reprehensible. How can Republicans stand with him? You have to understand what people vote on. One of the president's greatest successes, and I'm not saying I agree or disagree, is two Supreme Court justices, and maybe he'll potentially get a third. And beyond that, a record number of federal judges appointed to the bench. The president's truest hardcore base are white evangelicals. He has 98% approval rating. If you didn't know about the judges, you would think that base doesn't stand with the president, given his conduct, his lifestyle, his behavior. But for that voting base, they're not going to know the president's name or his conduct or care about it in 4 years or 8 years. But for that base, these judges, these record number of federal judges on the bench and the Supreme Court justices, they couldn't be happier about. Our justice system impacts almost every aspect of their life. And I could say, I hate the way the courts are being stacked, but take how I feel out and just get technical. If you like the way the courts are being stacked and packed, it's an enormous win. So as it relates to the president and impeachment, it all depends on every voting member of Congress, you know, the Congress and the Senate, and what their priorities are. But as these testimonies have been laid out over the last 2 weeks, I will tell you it is stunning. We're 11 people deep who are not hyperpartisan, who are not never Trumpers, who are not political. For the most part, they are lifetime diplomats. Alexander Vindmar, the man who testified yesterday, who we saw the White House call a never Trumper, we saw certain members of right wing media saying he's a traitor, he's a Ukrainian national, he's a double agent. This man's a decorated war veteran. He earned a Purple Heart serving the U.S. government overseas when he got wounded. He's devoted his life to our country. So you can say you like what he says or you hate what he says, but the man's a patriot. And one of the things that could or will be damning to the president is, until now, this phone call that we talk about, the White House has said, it's all hearsay. In Alexander's part, it's not. He was actually on the call with the president. And whether or not the whistleblower ever gets unmasked, at this point, you've got six people who almost word for word have corroborated what the whistleblower said happened. And it's not just about this one phone call. It's about multiple phone calls and meetings and messengers, whether it's Rudy Giuliani or Rick Perry or Vice President Pence, who worked with the president. And we know that military aid was held back. And you and I could say, military aid, that's not something I'm thinking about. Or I remember a week ago, the president's daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, was talking about the Kurds in Turkey and Syria. She said most Americans would have to Google what a Kurd is. She's not wrong. But our national security and our brand and our position as a global superpower and who we are matters. And I think that's what a lot of people are going to be thinking about as they go into the impeachment inquiry. And I don't know what will happen. It's not about convincing President Trump's hardcore base. For Democrats, it's about getting a handful of Republicans to say, I am a true conservative. I am a lifetime Republican. But this action or this person or what they're doing doesn't represent who I am or what I believe. So we'll see.
We're talking with Stephanie Ruhle on Downtown. I want to talk about some of the topics you're discussing on Modern Rules, the podcast. And let's start with feminism. What does it mean to be a feminist in 2019?
So here's what I think is interesting. I think people don't know the answer to that question. People are very quick to label themselves a feminist. But we asked all sorts of women, different ages, different demographics, and people define it in very different ways. And as amazing as the women's movement has been, I think something I've realized during our research, what feminism never has been is completely inclusive. And by inclusive, I mean more traditional women who live traditional lives. I mean stay-at-home moms like my own mother, who's the hardest working, toughest woman I know, who I assure you stands up for me and my sister and wants us to have every opportunity and equal pay, but she's never identified herself as a feminist. And so I brought her on and I asked her why. And she said, well, first of all, feminists have never included me. And when we're quick to judge one another, we don't realize there are a lot of women out there who choose to stay at home and raise their kids, which is one of the hardest, most 24/7 thankless jobs out there. But also a lot of people stay at home as caregivers because we don't have affordable child care in the United States. We don't. And I asked my mother why she doesn't identify as a feminist. And she said, have feminists ever really included me or cared about me? And you know something she said to me? She said, you, Stephanie, you were your, and I obviously I'm not saying this in a boastful way, I'm saying it more of a silly way. She said, you were your high school homecoming queen, and you were the captain of your cheerleading squad. But the truth is, you would never want your daughter to be those things, and I think you're ashamed of them. And I kind of balked, and I said, what do you mean? And she goes, well, tell me, would you want your daughter to be a cheerleader? And I said, well, no, actually, you know, I wouldn't, you know, I don't want her to take a role that's subservient to boys. And you know what she said to me? She said, bullshit. That is this brand that was made up somewhere. She's like, you are the most aggressive girl I know. And she goes, trust me, you've been standing front and center your whole life. So why are we branding this activity is what girls do, or this activity or what boys do, and this is less than or more than? And what if we all just tried to be whatever we are? And that falls right into this idea of toxic masculinity. It's not about saying alpha, in my opinion, or what I learned from the podcast, because at the end of every podcast, I bring in all different voices. I say, here's what I heard, here's what I think, and here's what I'm going to do. It's not about saying to that traditional alpha male, that macho man, you can't be that. But to me, maybe it's saying you can be that and more. The issue isn't masculinity. The issue is the word toxic. I remember visiting a school when my son was 4 years old with my husband. And on the tour, a fantastic woman, a great tour guide said, the boys play lacrosse on this field and the girls, the choir practice for girls is in there. And my husband didn't really notice that she said that, but I did. And I noticed it because that son of mine, my second son, he loves singing and he loves theater. He loves sports too, but he loves a lot of activities that in that school might be considered girl activities. And I know as a woman who I spent the first 14 years of my career on Wall Street, and by the way, Wall Street's a great business for women. Women just hadn't gone into it traditionally. We didn't have that opportunity. We didn't have a network. We didn't know about it. And so the idea that I'm trying to talk about here is we don't have to have designated lanes, right? It doesn't mean we have to be gender neutral. It doesn't mean we're not going to call our daughter her and a boy him. But it just means let's just teach our kids to be the best they are. I don't know if you're a dad, but when you go home tonight and take care of your kids, you're not going to be babysitting them. You're going to be parenting them. Moms say that they're parenting them. We hear a lot of dads say that they're babysitting. And I'm not saying I'm going to get angry about it or hypersensitive, but these are tiny things to be aware of, like my kids. Recently, my six-year-old daughter, we asked her what she wanted to be when she grew up, and she said, I want to do what dad does. And I said, you want to be a hedge fund trader? And I said, you don't want to work in TV, right? I'm like, you know, the hair, the makeup, the fun. And she said, no, I want to do the job that pays the money. And I said, what? And I said, why do you think dad makes the money and I don't make money? I go to work every day. And you know what I realized? My daughter, my six-year-old, when I'm with my whole family, has never ever seen me pay. Because when I'm with my family, my husband always pays, my husband always drives, and he always has the keys to the house. And I'm not saying, oh, my God, we have to change our lives. But it's tiny little things like that that do impact the way girls think they should behave and the way boys think they should behave. So I'm not saying we should tear up the script. And yes, I do consider in many ways, my husband is a patriarch of our house. But it doesn't mean I'm not his partner. It doesn't mean that he can't pick my kids up at school or change a diaper. And it doesn't mean that I can't change a tire. I don't want to. I absolutely don't want to. It's that if we think more about people just trying to get by and be their best, I think we can get away from the hypersensitivity around labels, whether it's feminism, masculinity, our position, our political position. And we realize most people are just trying to get by.
Before we let you go, Stephanie, I wanted to ask briefly about the topic of forgiveness. It seems to have become a lost art in America. Why is that?
I will tell you, it's time to bring it back. America loves a fight, but we also love a comeback. And a person, two people who impacted me the most in this podcast, the first was a woman named Alice Johnson. You may have heard her name. She was sentenced to life in prison for a non-violent drug-related offense. She was involved in a big drug scandal, and she was sentenced to jail for the rest of her life. And it was through social media and Kim Kardashian that her story rose to prominence, and President Trump commuted her sentence. And Alice and I have spent a lot of time together, and what I found the most amazing about her, she's a really, really joyful, faithful woman. And she forgives everyone. She forgives the bad public defender that she had. She forgives the people who lied, who turned on her, who flipped on her so they could get lighter sentences. And what I learned from her was not forgiving gives that other person power over you. Anger holds you up. It blocks you. And Alice said she forgives those people because they don't matter. She wants to live a life of joy. I interviewed a woman named Nicole Hockley. Nicole lost her 7-year-old son to the Sandy Hook massacre in Newtown, Connecticut years ago. She doesn't give the shooter the power to hold space in her mind and her heart. Think about that. Think about how much time you and I give to holding grudges or being pissed at work, or especially now that we exist, texting and emailing me. And when you wake up annoyed, you misread texts, you misread emails because you're annoyed. What if you try to let those things go?
That's great advice. Stephanie, thanks so much. Really enjoy your work. The podcast is Modern Rules. And of course, watch Stephanie every day on MSNBC. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you for caring. I appreciate it.
Stephanie Ruhle with us here on Downtown.